What is life, mind and matter?
My name is John Atkins. I'm a research professor in the biochemistry department in UCC, and I study non-standard readout of hereditary information.
I'm David McConnell, professor of genetics at Trinity College in the Smurfit Institute of Genetics. And broadly speaking, I have studied the way in which genes are regulated.
It was Watson and Crick who in 1953 in Cambridge proposed a model for the structure of DNA, which we now know to be the correct one.
If you imagine a ladder and you have actually got four different kinds of steps in the ladder, and now you can imagine a ladder which is 3 billion steps long. That's what the human DNA essentially looks like. But the order of those steps is the genetic information. As a result of Watson and Crick, we could see that the genetic information was encoded in these chemicals.
The hereditary material of all known organisms on Earth is DNA, apart from some viruses which are not functional organisms as such and are dependent upon organisms for which DNA is the hereditary material.
RNA is ribonucleic acid, DNA is deoxyribonucleic acid, and the difference between them is one oxygen atom in a particular place, and also one other change which is relatively minor. So they're very similar chemicals. However, DNA is actually very stable chemically. RNA is, relatively speaking, unstable. That's a very important quality which, in a way, fits DNA to be, in most cases, the genetic material, and RNA to be involved in regulating the genetic material.
Relatively new use of DNA, in a sense, is for forensics, for determining the identity of people from small samples. There's a very sensitive amplification procedure, and so from really minute samples, you're able to get specific information which can be used for tracing purposes, the identity of the person who left a sample behind, or for the relationship between peoples. And in a broader sense, this sort of determining the relationship between people is important for genealogy, but also in terms of the origin of peoples and how they've moved throughout the world during the course of human migrations in different parts of the world and colonized different parts of the world can be traced very effectively from DNA. Sequence analysis, but also, in fact, not just the relationship between different humans, it's the relationship between different organisms on Earth. And so we can have a tree of life, as it were, and we can trace the connectiveness of related species and the origin of them.
This whole story of evolution, we know that it was Darwin who first put it on a solid basis in the middle of the 19th century, and subsequently the botanists and zoologists and paleontologists produced evidence for the relationship of different kinds of organisms. But once we knew about DNA, it became possible to only analyze the DNA of all creatures on the planet, and you can compare these DNAs and you can show which organisms are most closely related to each other. So, for example, it's not too surprising that chimpanzees are our closest relative, and so on. And by the way, the next is the gorilla, and after that it's the orangutan, and then there's the gibbons, and so on. So you can build up a family tree, but you can build up a family tree for everything. And you can show that every organism on the planet is related to every other organism. That means we're related to the HIV virus. You know, anything, it doesn't matter. Grass, a redwood tree, those are our relatives. And all that comes out of the DNA. You don't even need to look at the tree to know that actually it's a relative of ours, because you can analyze the DNA. And that's truly astonishing. We can also put dates on when we had, for the sake of the argument, a common relative with the chimpanzee. It turns out to be 7 million years ago. You can also put a date on when all modern humans had a common ancestor, and that's about 200,000 years ago. All that comes out of Watson and Crickery of 1953.
The use of DNA is much more prevalent than that. For instance, in various disease states and different forms of cancer, there's sequencing going on, trying to determine the cause of them, as indeed with many other diseases.
Pre-implantation diagnosis is a method by which scientists, doctors, medical scientists, can take a tiny piece from a very early embryo, even as little as one cell, preferably a few more, and can tell whether the embryo has a serious genetic disorder or will, or the child would have a serious genetic disorder or not. So this is extremely important for families which are unfortunate enough that they maybe have had a child already with a very serious genetic disorder and would like to try to ensure that they will not have another one with that genetic disorder. There are certain kinds of breast cancer caused by mutations in genes, and these can be avoided using the method of pre-implantation diagnosis.
It's becoming more and more common now to carry out what amounts to a very detailed analysis of human cancers at the DNA level, so that you may test for the presence of between 50 and 100 so-called cancer genes. That's a shorthand for saying genes which are mutated in cancers, allowing the pathologists and the physicians to distinguish between one kind of cancer and another with much greater accuracy, and therefore to prescribe more appropriate therapies. Astonishing stuff. It's interesting to reflect on the importance of our understanding of DNA in some recent medical decisions, policy decisions in Ireland. For example, the decision to make the vaccine against human papillomavirus, this is the virus that causes cervical cancer, to make that vaccination program available in Ireland. I had actually had lunch the other day with Zurhausen, the man who did all the basic work on this. And I can tell you, it's absolutely plain. There's no way in which we would have been able to develop those vaccines, which are going to save thousands, millions of lives, I expect, without the DNA technology and the understanding of the structure of DNA. We would have been totally unable to analyze as quickly as we did the nature of HIV. People knew about AIDS, but they didn't know what was causing it. But it was through extraordinarily clever DNA and RNA work, because the HIV virus is an RNA virus, to analyze that virus, define it, and also specifically to develop what people know is called the triple therapy. This is the therapy which is used. All that came out of DNA work. One of the most dramatic, effects of DNA technology, understanding the structure of DNA, being able to analyze that structure, is, of course, in forensic genetics, forensic DNA work, what people commonly call DNA fingerprinting. And that has that. I know that the forensic scientists regard that as the greatest innovation in forensic science since the original fingerprints were introduced, which was just pre-1900, if I remember correctly. And it has absolutely changed the way in which forensic science of obviously certain kinds of cases is done. Each of us has a completely unique genetic fingerprint. That is, except in the case of identical twins. And with tiny amounts of material, even, for example, if I cough, I've stolen a car and I cough, the windscreen will have little tiny pieces of my cough, and you can take from that enough DNA to get my DNA fingerprint and identify me. Now, there are obviously very important legal issues here, but they're not insuperable.
Well, it's true with many technologies or many changes that it can be used for good or for bad. It's a societal decision as to how to use any particular technology. But what we are finding out is a large amount of how things work, and there's possibilities for intervention in many ways. I mean, one of the bad things you could imagine out of some of the biology work is some sort of bioterrorism thing using some of the newer techniques. And you can imagine other things as well. But society has had decisions to make. But we are understanding where we come from and what we can do and how to ameliorate all sorts of problems. Well, Jim Watson's quote about DNA is the only one who was hurt by DNA analysis was Bill Clinton. Actually, no, it was making fun, of course. It was actually in this. Well, people asked him, oh, but it's so dangerous what you're finding out, what it can be used for. Well, the only one who's been hurt so far, was the reply. In fact, it's Bill Clinton, because he, for obvious reasons,
with the dress.
This is Jim Watson replying to a question, because of the dress, of course.
I think one of the most interesting things about DNA, from an Irish perspective, is the fact that Irish scientists or scientists in Ireland made some very significant contributions. So I'll mention J.D. Bernal, who was born in Tipperary, who became in the 1920s, 1930s, into the 40s, one of the leading scientists in the field of X-ray crystallography. Now, that's the field that played a very important role in getting the structure of DNA. And a second person who made an important contribution was Maurice Wilkins, whose mother and father were Irish. They left Ireland in the early 1900s to go to New Zealand. He was a Trinity-educated doctor. Morris was born in New Zealand. They came back to Ireland in the very early 1920s, intending to settle here. But there were better opportunities for his father in London, so they went to London. Morris was educated and brought up in England. And he's the third man of the double helix. And he received a Nobel Prize with Watson and Crick for the discovery of the double helix. So Irish genes in Wilkins, no question about it.
Lest we become too smug, however, some concern that in the current Irish schools curriculum that the imbalance between the amount of emphasis on molecular biology, on DNA and RNA, compared to the macrobiology is not the right one. And so to try and stimulate some interest, we introduced a prize for the best essay or poem either in the post-primary schools anywhere throughout the island of Ireland or for primary schools in a restricted geographical area, which coincidentally happens to be West Cork and South Kerry. And Jim Watson will present the prize to the winners if they choose to have it presented in person at the opening of the sculpture.
1953, the discovery of DNA, 2013, 60 years. So we're celebrating 60 years of DNA and everything that has come from the discovery of the structure of DNA. And John Atkins and I, we thought it would be a good idea to celebrate this in a way that the public could take advantage of. So we decided to commission a sculpture by quite a famous, internationally known American sculptor, Charles Jenks. The wonderful thing about this sculpture is it will not only show DNA in an 18-foot sculpture in aluminium, but it would also show or illustrate to some extent the enormous increase in greater understanding we have of the role of RNA. And this sculpture is going to be unveiled in the National Botanic Gardens. It will be unveiled by James D. Watson of Watson and Crick. It's wonderful that he's willing to come and willing to celebrate with us 60 years of his great discovery. And, of course, he's participating in discoveries in celebrations all around the world. But he's coming to us. Well, we do hope that this sculpture in the National Botanic Gardens will encourage everybody who sees it, especially young people, to ask questions about the natural world around them and to become interested in trying to explain, understand the natural world, and to participate in the great enterprise of science, which is, after all, one of the greatest of the universal human activities. I mean, pop music, soccer and science, those are the three things which go all around the globe. Everything else is restricted in one way or another, but science is truly international, and it is wonderful and exciting.